that.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, folks, it's Phil Auerswald back tonight after Michael led your guys' awesome pitch session. I was tracking the tweets, and as soon as I got off stage, was really just couldn't wait to tune in and hear what you guys had been coming up with, and so many really fantastic ideas. And I know that there's a lot more out there in this group. And as Michael said, we're going to be scheduling another pitch session at a different time, one that's not going to require folks to get up at 4 and 5 in the morning, as some of you all did. But anyway, so thanks so much for that, and thanks to Michael for having done such a great job with it. As Michael pointed out, Michael summarized the assignments that you all have at the start of the pitch session last week. I'm not going to go over that same material, but if you missed the pitch session, you certainly should listen to last week's session and do pay particular attention to the first few minutes of that where Michael outlined the requirements, assignments for the course, and the process for sending them in so that we can get certificates to as many of you as possible. And anybody who's tuning in, anybody who's been following the course, doing the readings, staying with us, we really urge you to take this to the finish line. It's going to be great for us to have, certainly to have as many people who participated complete the course and get a certificate. And we're really hoping that for you guys as well, having a Ashoka U Entrepreneurship and Globalization course certificate will be of some use and value. Anyhow, so that's all the administrative stuff. We are very near the end of the course, and just super excited to have another fantastic guest tonight. And so my friend Lila Janela, who is the founder of Samasource, is on with us tonight. And Lila's going to tell her own story, so I'm not going to summarize too much. I think we've known each other, I don't know, 3 or 4 years now. And so it's been really fun to see her venture take off. I think the first time we spoke about it, she had definitely launched, but it was just past project stage. And now she's got 5 years worth of funding potentially lined up. She got some things in the works that aren't, fully announced, but she's really looking towards a really secure future for her venture. So really exciting stuff. And Lila, thank you, and welcome to Ashoka U Online.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Phil. I'm excited to be here.
So, once again, we're going to start out by talking about personal backgrounds. We talk a lot in this course about writing your own story and what that means and how entrepreneurship fits into that. And you certainly are a person who, very early on, being done with college, I think decided that you were going to be writing your own story. So what does that look like so far for you?
Well, we're super excited about this funding and where we can go with it. One of the big challenges, and David Bornstein alluded to this in a recent piece in the New York Times, I'm not sure if your students saw it, on restricted funding for nonprofits. One of the things he mentioned was that restricted funding makes it extremely challenging to do any sort of strategic, work or planning, and it makes it very hard to be agile. So from our perspective, having funding for the next 5 years that's really in line with our core operations is a huge win, and just, really makes the road look a lot smoother from this end.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic. So let's take us back to the beginning. Pre-Samasource, what brought you into this concept? Why did you do it? What excited you about it at the outset?
Sure. Well, I first got interested in poverty alleviation and international development when I was 16. I got a scholarship from the Lorillard Tobacco Company, of all places. I was in high school, and I felt really weird about using money from Big Tobacco to fund my fancy Ivy League education. I thought I'd apply to colleges on the East Coast. So I decided to use the money instead to go and do some volunteer work. And I thought I would use it to volunteer in a developing country. My parents both come from India, but I grew up in a suburb of Southern California. And though they tried to teach us about India and tell us to eat all the food on our plates because there were starving kids back home and that sort of thing, I never really got what poverty was like outside of the U.S. And so I thought, you know, why don't I take this time to try to learn about that? And truth be told, I was also interested in pursuing some kind of an adventure. I was bored. I was kind of a restless high school student, and I wanted to get out and explore the world, and I thought this would be a nice way to do that. So I convinced the scholarship committee and my high school guidance counselor to let me graduate early, and I took off in what would have been the second semester of my senior year in college to West Africa, and I ended up teaching English at a school for the blind in Ghana. I had no knowledge of teaching or working with blind students or working in a poor country. So it was kind of thrown into the mix. And I thought I would somehow teach these kids what they needed to know and would help to uplift this poor village from poverty. And, of course, I got there and realized that they had a lot more to offer me than I did them. And the primary thing I learned when I was there was how much human talent goes to waste in developing countries. Partly because we tend to write off people who are poor as incapable of doing anything productive in the global economy. Now, I certainly think that people need basic health and education services, and we have a long way to go to provide those services. But what I found really remarkable was the level of talent that was there in a place like Ghana, which at that time was still a pretty poor country as it is now. Though it was so poor, I found so many young people who could speak beautiful English, who were literate, who could read and write, and who were motivated to do work, but there was just a complete lack of opportunity for them. So I decided to study international development and to try to understand why countries like Ghana, which seemed so rich in human capital, were so poor, and ended up studying international development with a focus on Africa at Harvard, and later working for various organizations. I worked for Ashoka in India. I worked for the World Bank for a time. And I kind of learned that what I think is the key to poverty alleviation is job creation. It's figuring out a way to connect people to work so that they can pay for their own local services. And increasingly in developing countries, a lot of the services that we take for granted in the developed world, like having access to clean water or basic sanitation, you have to pay for in the developing world. And so giving people a paycheck is actually a really powerful way to let them make choices about these services and tends to impact all of the indicators that development economists and social activists care about. So I think it's probably the most effective way to handle human rights issues, to secure political and social freedoms, to ensure that people have adequate health and education resources. So to try to make a long story somewhat shorter, after I graduated from college, ended up working in management consulting, thinking that the solution to job creation couldn't really be found in the traditional aid world. So I decided not to pursue a career at the World Bank and instead focus on learning about business. And my first consulting project was for a big outsourcing company in India, and I was shipped off to Bombay to help the CEO of a 20,000-person outsourcing company figure out some of his strategies. And what I learned then was that one really powerful way to create jobs in poor places is through digital work. At the time, outsourcing was creating millions of jobs in places like big cities in India and the Philippines and China, and it had created 7 billionaires. And I thought, you know, if a few guys can become billionaires in this industry, then surely we could figure out a way to invert that pyramid and send a few dollars to billions of people who need it and who can do this work. And that was when the idea for Thaumasource was born.
So I'm just a little curious. Was this decision or conclusion that it was really going to be through business and enterprise that the young people that you had been working with were most likely to find opportunity. Was this as a consequence of specific experiences you had
for example, the World Bank, or experiences you had, you mentioned that you had spent some time with Ashoka as well, or was it really more out of your study and academic programs that you came to that conclusion?
You know, most of it was experiential. My time with Ashoka was enlightening. I was very lucky in that I got to hang out at the Bombay office. I'm not even sure if there is a Bombay office anymore, or a Mumbai office, rather. At the time, I was drafting what was called the Law for All initiative in India, which was Ashoka's attempt to integrate human rights thinking with India policy. And so part of that work involved going out and interviewing social entrepreneurs, and it was such a joy and so inspiring to meet some of the Ashoka fellows in the area. I met, for example, one woman who made a huge impact on me named Sister Jan, and she was a Belgian nun who had moved to India decades ago and started organizing domestic workers so that they could be recognized under Indian labor law. Which is quite progressive, but of course 95% of workers who are in the informal sector are not recognized under that law and therefore often mistreated. So she was really inspiring to me, and I think seeing her experience of organizing these workers made me think that, you know, if you can find a way to create dignified employment, people can help themselves. And I kept seeing time and time again when I was in the field, you know, I'd go and talk to people. I'd go visit my students' homes and talk to their parents, and I when I was in India, I spent a lot of time just talking to rickshaw drivers and people that I met on the street who were engaged in informal work, and really came to the conclusion that what everybody wanted was a good job. And interestingly, there's a great book out by the CEO of Gallup, Jim Clifton, called The Coming Jobs War. And Gallup probably has the best data of any organization in the world on what people are thinking. And all of their polling data shows that what people want most around the world in any country, more than peace or an end to terrorism or health services or, you know, love, what they want more than anything else is a decent job. And that was absolutely confirmed, you know, much more by my experiences than by my coursework.
So we've had some conversation, some with Fadi Handour and some with Angel Cabrera about globalization and what it means for the world, the majority of the world's population, to be joining the global economy, this process that is a sort of focal point of our conversations in this class. And obviously this is a topic where there's a lot of concern about the extension of supply chains into remote places, into places that have been previously disconnected from global exchange, you know, what that can mean. How do you see that discussion? I mean, you talked about jobs, but how would you weigh jobs that are sort of connected with global supply chains as compared with sort of local work, local agriculture, that's also a way to earn a livelihood?
That's such a good question, and I'm sure it's on the minds of a lot of a lot of people listening. One of the things I struggle with is the fact that Thomasaurus kind of accepts the rules of the game, and accepts that, you know, the world economy is structured the way it is, and accepts that we have to operate within that. And it does get frustrating for me. You know, I think there's a lot of truth to the argument that we've kind of absorbed a lot of people in poor places into a system that they didn't really have much choice over, and they certainly didn't have a say in whether their countries or societies kind of adopted these systems. And if you look at the way that the economic system has been structured, a lot of the reforms that the IMF and the World Bank have advocated and put in place in developing countries were ushered in during times of dictatorship or, you know, military control, where people didn't really have a say in those reforms. So it's a reality that many people are living under a system that they wouldn't necessarily have chosen, that's basically been ushered in by very powerful economic interests in the West. However, I'm a pragmatist, and I really believe that the best way to help people is to alleviate suffering now, in addition to working concertedly to make structural reform happen in the future. But if we ignore people's challenges now, they suffer in the short term and may not even be around in the future to participate in those debates. So as a pragmatist, I think that we're kind of, you know, we've already accepted that capitalism is a dominant order, and there are many people working to kind of change it. But within this system, there are ways that we can make poor people less vulnerable and give them more of a say. And all the data shows that the best way to do that is to enfranchise them as producers in the global economy. What's interesting about the movement to support local small business, and I absolutely think that's a step in the right direction and hugely, you know, in awe of what microfinance organizations have done to provide poor people access to capital so that they can start their own businesses. But the challenge with a lot of the sort of local business movement is that in very poor places, you're basically recycling very tiny amounts of capital in starved economies. So if you look at places like, you know, some of the areas that we work, rural Indian villages, there's not a lot of capital to go around. So you might be able to fund a local business to, you know, a local businesswoman to produce more of a good that she's selling locally, but she's still selling that good to other people who make less than $2 a day. And so the challenges she's going to face in really scaling that to escape poverty herself or provide a service that will better the lives of a lot of people in her village, the challenges are just enormous and overwhelming. And you know, it's unlikely that one of these small loans will really lift her substantially out of poverty anytime soon. And really the only concrete kind of benefits we've seen, you know, in terms of poverty alleviation have been from foreign direct investment and global trade. And we know that without a doubt that poor economies are enriched when they trade with richer economies. However, what we also know is that the benefit tends to accrue disproportionately to rich people in the poor countries. And very rarely does a lot of the economic benefit really truly trickle down to the poor. So what SolidSource does is try to directly connect poor people into trade with relatively wealthy economies, and in our case, relatively wealthy institutions, big technology companies that have a lot of money to spend on digital services. And we think that model is really interesting because basically we get big tech companies to pay for international development. They are directly sending money into places that would never ordinarily see direct cash transfers from, you know, from those kinds of institutions. And what that does is it provides a new stream of capital into a place that was previously disconnected. And I think that that's in general a very good thing and tends to give the people in those economies more of a say as to how they're treated, more of a political say. We've seen that the income that particularly that women in conservative areas of places like India, you know, the impact of that additional income has a social effect that is quite profound. And I think that effect is more profound than the effect of smaller cash transfers through systems like microfinance or even direct, you know, conditional or unconditional cash transfers.
Well, I think that's a really great set of points. I mean, Tim was just saying, he just tweeted, she's saying so many quotable things so fast, I can't keep up. I'm sort of the same way. I like to tweet a little bit, you know, what I think are the highlights when we have guests on, but we're not keeping up with you from that standpoint. But I think we're with your argument and the points you're making, and I think the points you're making is really, you know, sequence of points are really powerful. So, I mean, that brings us, you know, you started as a talk about the SolidSource model and how you see the process of connecting people in poor places to work opportunities that are offered by large multinationals or in other ways linked to global supply chains and the way in which this allows for new resources to come to poor communities and really drive development. So that's all really powerful. I want to go back to, you know, sometime roughly around when we first ran into each other 3 or 4 years ago, and you were
I mean, what do you consider to be the founding date for AsamaSource, before we get into that?
Mm-hmm. September 2008.
So it was roughly around then. So you had a concept, you had a motivation. When you first started, what was sort of idea or set of ideas? How did you think you could get going with this concept?
Sure. Well, the core idea was use this new trend of outsourcing of digital work, but somehow kind of invert it so that the beneficiaries were poor people and not kind of wealthy entrepreneurs in big cities in developing countries. So it was, figure out a way to somehow get poor people to benefit from this giant global trade and services. And I was very lucky to be able to stand on the shoulders of an amazing entrepreneur and organization that is Digital Divide Data, and the founder, Jeremy Hawkenstein, who is really a pioneer in this field of what's now being called impact sourcing, has formed his organization, I think, in 1999 or 2000. And he had a similar story. He was, after his undergraduate years, had gone to Cambodia, and I think he was at Harvard as an undergrad, and so it made a connection that these four women that he'd met in Cambodia, many of whom were former sex workers and would go back into the trade because they couldn't find decent jobs, that they could be taught to do digitization work. And I think he'd connected with the Crimson and understood that there was a big need to digitize the Harvard Crimson, which is our college newspaper, the Harvard Crimson Archive, and kind of connected the dots that he could train these women to digitize those archives through the Internet because, there are none of the traditional barriers for shipping digital services that exist for shipping real products. And so he created this model, and Digital Divide Data has grown since then. And their model was to digitize newspaper and magazine archives and to do that first in Cambodia, and now they've actually moved into Kenya. And in the early days of starting AsamaSource, I actually didn't want to start a new organization, so I went to Jeremy. I had a connection to him through a mutual friend and said, hey, can I start a version of Digital Divide Data in Africa? And he chuckled and he said, look, I think you're an ambitious entrepreneur. I support what you're doing, but I don't think it'll work in Africa. The cost structure there is too high. It certainly won't work with the kind of work that we're doing. But he was incredibly generous. He gave me his financial model. He was our first fiscal sponsor and helped us get started. And then we realized that, in order to work in Africa, we would have to pursue a slightly different model from Digital Divide Data, which is what we did and part of what justified me creating a different organization. So my idea kind of evolved from just simply outsourcing work to poor people to breaking the work down into small units. And that was really the formation of the micro work model, which has paved the way for a lot of our success. Now, micro work is basically the idea of taking a big digital project and breaking it down into small units of work that take from a few minutes to, maximum an hour to complete, and then reassembling all those little pieces of work that are done by different people in different locations and sending the work back to the customer. And when you use technology to break down the work like that and manage the workflow, there are a lot of efficiencies you gain, and there's also the benefit of being able to hire people who are not as skilled as if you, as if you have to send them a whole project. So, for example, we don't need to train our workers in project management or very high-level skills. And the best analogy to use with micro-work is the assembly line. So, when Ford decided that he wanted to mass-produce the automobile, what he realized is that the only way to do that would be to break down the process of manufacturing into these small units so that you could train people to do specific things rather than have to have one person build a whole car and have the knowledge of every piece of the car and how it fits together. And so that analogy, when applied to digital work, is really the micro work model. And that's what's allowed AsamaSource to scale so rapidly over the last 4 years. We've now paid out and trained close to 3,000 people, and we've paid them over $2 million as of today, and we've paid out $1 million of those dollars in the last year. In other words, we did in the last year what it took us 3 years to do before that. So we're starting to see pretty dramatic rates of growth in our model.
Do you think you're done growing?
Absolutely not. I wish our staff were around to hear that. I think we are at the beginning of what I'd like to think is a micro-work movement that I'd like to see Thamasore seed in the same way that Muhammad Yunus with Grameen seeded microfinance in a way that, you know, made it grow beyond Grameen and beyond Yunus. We have had requests, and every day I get requests from, you know, places from Siberia to Colombia to, I was just in Jamaica where the Prime Minister is a big fan. Every day we get requests to expand our model into different countries and regions, and we just can't operationally manage that right now with the budget that we have and the staff that we have. So we've thought about different ways that we can help promote micro work even beyond Thamasore. One of those ideas is to make available our technology so that other organizations can start picking it up and building their own centers, which is something that we'll probably start doing in 2013.
Great. Now, I remember at the outset you had a concept of focusing on refugee populations as being particularly vulnerable and particularly in need of connectedness and deprived of opportunities. So how did that idea, a particular focus, work out?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned it. So the idea came about because in the early days of Thamasore, I knew an enterprising young woman named Kirsten Erickson who was running a group called Forge, which works with refugees in Congolese refugees in Zambia. And I also had read an Oxfam report about a place called Dadaab, which is a refugee camp in Kenya, widely known to be one of the worst in the world because it's so overcrowded. It now holds close to 900,000 Somali refugees, and many of those people have been living there for 20 years since the camp was founded because the situation in Somalia has only deteriorated. So I'd read about this camp, and I'd read that in Dadaab that the Danish Refugee Council had funded two computer labs with satellite internet access, and that refugees were doing online university courses from within Dadaab. And I thought that was really cool. And I thought they probably need immediate income more than they need a degree from a university in the UK that they can't really apply to any sort of income-generating activity. So I thought, you know, maybe there's a way that we could make the micro-work model happen there. And as I read more about the refugee populations around the world, I thought this model makes so much sense for people who are forced to leave their country and uprooted from their traditional line of work. In Dadaab, there are people who used to be lawyers and doctors in Somalia who are stuck in this camp and basically forbidden from leaving. And it's an incredibly frustrating thing for a person to endure. And the nice thing about this model is it gives people a chance to do work from wherever they happen to be, and it gives them portable skills so that if they do end up being able to return to their country or if they shift to a different camp, as often happens with refugees, or move to a different country, they have skills that they can take with them. So this was a really kind of appealing target population for us, and we tried it both in Zambia and in Dadaab. And I will say very frankly that we failed in both cases. And here's why. In Zambia, we realized we had some very talented young workers, but we didn't really have the operational capacity there to run a center. So there were technology issues, there were management issues, and bottom line, we couldn't really send enterprise-level work out to that center because those constraints just prevented people from being effective workers. In Dadaab, we actually had hired a staff person to manage the center who was really good, and the infrastructure was problematic but not as challenging as it was in Zambia. But the bigger issue we encountered there was security. There were some widely publicized attacks on Kenyan aid workers who run the camp last year, and it's an ongoing source of concern. In fact, the Kenyan government has declared a war on the rebels who commit these terrorist attacks. So it's not a really safe place for me to feel comfortable sending staff. And it was heartbreaking to make the decision, but ultimately we decided not to maintain an operation in Dadaab, for fear of harming our own people, which is just something that I can't do. However, one thing that we've noticed is that refugees who end up making it out of Dadaab, who can find their way to Nairobi, have contacted us about joining some of our centers in Nairobi. And when they have work permits and are eligible to work in Kenya, we've been very happy to set them up with our centers. I hope long-term we can work out some kind of an arrangement where refugees could successfully do this work. We've also tried this experiment in Dharamshala in India and have found that the workers are generally capable. They just need a way to they just need a center to report into that sort of meets our technology requirements. But, you know, it's definitely something that we look forward to doing more of in the future.
I think that's a great story, though, of aspiration, a vision for a way to really make a difference in people's lives, but also just kind of running into the realities of sometimes doing everything at once isn't possible. I mean, really having to make choices, it sounds like that partly was what this was about, was just prioritizing the thing that you could get done first. Is that the way you would characterize it, or...?
It's definitely the way I characterize it, and it breaks my heart. I mean, I'm Facebook friends with some of the refugees that I met in Dadaab when we did our first training there. I did it personally, and I took an armed convoy there, and we had an amazing volunteer from Stanford Business School who came out with me, and you know, we were kind of weeping at the end of it because it was just so upsetting. I'm not a big crier, but it would take a very hardened soul not to be upset by the kinds of things that I saw in Dadaab, which is just the egregious waste of basically a million people's lives. And they're sitting there in this dusty, dry place, unable to do anything and unable to leave. So it breaks my heart. But sometimes in order to help people, you know, you have to prioritize and take things. And I think if we'd gone whole hog on the refugee strategy, we would not be where we are today, and we wouldn't be in a position where I think long-term we can really help these populations. So I think some of the things that are necessary to help them we're starting to put in place now. And I think it's going to be a personal commitment of mine to figure out ways to get refugees on board in greater number in the future. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, these trade-offs are often the hardest thing for leaders to make. But you've got to be realistic and pragmatic. And at the end of the day, you know, you just have to kind of look at the numbers and be realistic.
Yeah. Well, no, it's, I think that's a great insight. And I'm sure anybody who has built something as you have has experienced similar moments. I'm encouraging our crowd here to tweet us some questions or call in, and we'll be going to some questions in just a couple minutes. But before we do that, one other, this is in the sort of different category, an aspirational idea that I know you've had in mind, but that has always been kind of a when you get to it sort of, or when it's feasible kind of concept. But still something that I've been really interested in. And this is the idea you suggested a little while back of blending into your micro work assignments some learning related tasks, something not unlike the online coursework that we're doing here. I mean, giving people a chance to sort of complete certificates and really build their skills during some part of their time that they're engaged with SamaSource. Where is that concept, and is it still something you're thinking about? Do you think there's a future for something like that?
So Sama School, as we're calling it, is very much a part of our plans. In fact, part of our funding that we received at the beginning of the month is being directed to Sama School. The part of the challenge with implementing it now is that there are some core product improvements that we need to make. We have an engineering team right now of four who work, as you might imagine, and they're supporting. Now we've paid and trained close to 3,000 workers. They're supporting a huge number of workers and paying customers on this platform that we built from scratch. So they're just trying to, like, plug the holes and keep it together and make sure that we don't go under. But we now have the funding to bring on an additional team to focus on building out our worker reputation tools. And Sauna School is really kind of part of that. So we're building a system where workers can have a career path. And as part of that path within Sauna Source, they have the ability to complete educational kinds of requirements and then earn a reputation for those as well. So some of the educational, quote-unquote, tasks are things like watching videos to learn soft skills of working in a professional environment. English skills, we do English assessment tests and have found that in the course of doing work, Sauna Source workers invariably improve their English pretty dramatically just because they're spending a lot of time on the English language web and then completing what we call goals tasks, which are tasks in the system which have known answers. So when workers complete those tasks, they get feedback on whether they got the question right or wrong and some kind of, you know, personalized kind of learning comes from that. So so a lot of our education is really focused on training people to be better at doing digital work and giving them marketable skills that we know our clients are willing to pay for. So they're very valuable in places where most of the education and training is really not connected to market demand and need.
Yeah, right. Well, that's it's something that it, in some ways it is happening naturally through the platform you've developed and with the workers that you already have kind of involved in Sauna Source. But there's also going to be a next step. Is that what I heard?
Yeah, so we're definitely already embarking on a lot of the worker training kind of elements that are critical to our success, because we really have to have an educated workforce to be able to do the work that we need to do. But the formalization of Sauna School into our product is something that's kind of gradually happening and will be more in full swing early next year.
Addie has a great question, and I think it's a relevant question on a week or a month when you're moving into the new office and really starting to look to the future of your organization without as much of a month-to-month pressure. But her question is, how has the structure of Sauna Source changed over the years to accommodate growth?
That's a really insightful question. Annie, it sounds like you might be an entrepreneur yourself. You know, in the early days, we didn't really have departments. We had just kind of people who were willing to make like a third of what they would make in the private sector or less and slave away and, you know, work crazy hours. So it was just kind of let's just try to get it done, and we didn't have time to think about how we wanted to structure the organization, you know, or any kind of even benefits or anything that you'd imagine a typical company. And as we've grown, I'd say that the major change has been that we've matured as a company and are now out of that sort of toddler teething stage. So we evolved several different functions, and really our business model is both the technology that we use, which is called the Sauna Hub, which is proprietary technology we built internally, but it's the marriage of that technology system that breaks down micro work with a really solid business process. And so we've evolved several different functions in the company. We have a delivery or professional services team that manages the work getting done and manages the selection of different centers and partners. We have a sales team that's focused on enterprise sales that goes out and acquires these deals, and that sales team has become a lot more formalized with very specific roles responsible for different types of customers in different geographies. We have an engineering team, of course, that builds and maintains the hub, and we now have a product person in that team. We've formalized an impact team, which manages ensuring that the workers who come into our system meet our income thresholds, so they have to be poor, and we have to be able to verify that. And that impact team also looks at measuring how much money workers make and ensuring that they're not poor by the time that they leave our system and that they stay not poor for the next 10 years, which is something that we don't have perfect data on now because we're pretty young, but we're gathering more as we go. So that's just you know, those are just some of the departments that SAMHSA's worked in, and that gives you a sense of how much we've formalized. But it really, it's interesting. You can't often set these departments up before you have enough sales or enough, you know, traction or volume within the company to warrant them. So we've grown organically, just like you might imagine any company, and added functions and kind of formalized the business as we go.
Did you have, I mean, when you look at the different activities within SAMHSA now, how close is it to what you envisioned as your set of tasks when you started out, or how much has it evolved and adapted, even in terms of the levels in the organization?
It's a great question. Some things are, I'd say, very much along the lines of what I predicted. You know, in my wildest dreams, I hoped we would be where we are now. You know, I hoped that we'd be able to prove that we could get to 1,000 workers paid out and trained. I had dreamed of getting to $1 million in wages paid out to workers, which is, you know, it doesn't seem like a lot. To give you a comparative kind of point, Kiva is now at over $300 million of volume that have gone through their system. So $1 million seems really puny compared to that. But I think for us, it's important to realize that giving work is a very, very different kind of thing than giving a loan. And the main reason is that really not only do we have to raise the money to build the technology and build the sales teams so they can go out and acquire these contracts, but the hardest thing is actually ensuring that somebody who previously made less than $3 a day and had zero formal employment experience, maybe they worked as a domestic worker, or we have some workers who literally worked in quarries breaking down small rocks into smaller rocks. And, you know, getting somebody with that kind of a background to come into a computer center and be able to do work that LinkedIn and eBay are willing to pay them for is really challenging. So, you know, I had dreamed of a day when we could get to $1 million in worker payments, just knowing how hard that would be. And it's just immensely satisfying and a great source of pride for me that we've recruited the kinds of people into the company that has built it into, you know, what it is now, and we've now paid out, as I mentioned, you know, over $2 million in wages. I did think that scaling would be easier. I kind of thought, oh, we'll build a technology platform and then things will just happen and we'll see that traditional hockey stick growth that you see in technology companies. But one of the things that's been reinforced to me over the years is that work is a very, very different thing from typical, you know, consumer technology. So the way that a Facebook grows or a LinkedIn grows is very, very different from how SAMHSA grows. We're not a marketplace. We have to go out and acquire each contract. And so scaling is job by job, person by person. And, you know, and that's been a very kind of humbling learning as we've grown.
Yeah, well, I you know, I can totally see that. Now we have another question from Nicole, who's actually a student from Georgetown University, who's part of our in-person class here at Mason, and her question is, how do you see your target worker population evolving in the future, if at all?
Great question. One of the reasons that we're a nonprofit and that I've been so adamant about being a nonprofit really has nothing to do with, you know, business structure, because in many ways, operationally, we look like a for-profit. We've got a sales team. We, you know, are very focused on hitting our sales numbers because that's where our impact comes from. But the reason that we're a nonprofit is that if we weren't, I think there'd be a very strong pressure from our investors to hire workers who are not poor. Turns out it's a lot harder to recruit people from places like slums who've never done this work before than middle-class people. And it's not harder because the workers are any less capable, but it's harder because they often don't see themselves as office workers. So they're not likely, if you put an ad in the newspaper in Nairobi for, you know, SAMHSA workers, you're not likely to find people from the target population because those people are not assuming that newspaper ads are designed for them. So you have to be kind of out of the box in recruiting people. You have to go to them. We have recruiting partners that go into the slums and find people there who meet our impact criteria. And that's not the sort of thing that investors who are concerned primarily with the financial return would want to support. So it's very important to me that we maintain our commitment to hiring workers who previously made below a living wage in their countries of origin. And we determine that by using the Fair Wage Guide, which is a guide that was set up by researchers at UC Berkeley and a bunch of fair trade organizations, and by World of Good, an amazing organization run by Priya Haji, a social entrepreneur in the Bay Area. And the Fair Wage Guide tells you, gives you a rough sense of what a living wage is in an urban and in a rural location in every country in the world. And that gives you a really good way of kind of assessing whether someone's poor in that local context. So as we think about expansion into places like the U.S., and we're actually, we have a grant to expand to test our model in the U.S. this year, we have a handy guide that can tell us what the income threshold should be. So as we grow, I think the way our workforce will evolve will hopefully be in the direction of recruiting poorer and poorer people as we make as we build more efficiencies into the model, as we're able to get a better reputation with our customers and potentially, you know, look at the way that we're pricing to price better, I fully believe that we can reach deeper and deeper into, you know, into the pool of impoverished people to get people who make, you know, well below a living wage in their countries of origin.
So you just mentioned building a program in the U.S. That presumably is in response to the reality that there are poor, disconnected people here as elsewhere in the world. But beyond that, was there a particular motivation for that, or was it just kind of a natural outgrowth of other work you've been doing?
Well, the 2010 census data was pretty shocking to me, as I'm sure it was to many of our listeners. You know, there are now 6 million Americans whose only income is food stamps. We've done away with a lot of our welfare programs in favor of food aid, but when you think about it, you know, there are a shocking number of Americans who are really dependent on, you know, basically on government handouts to survive, because the economy is so bad. You know, we have the worst economy since the Great Depression. We have unprecedented levels of unemployment. We have some cities that are becoming ghost cities. 1 in 6 Americans, this is shocking to me, but 1 in 6 Americans live in a family that makes less than $22,500, which is the federal poverty line, which, by the way, hasn't been adjusted in an egregiously long time. So we are living in a time when the income divide is really growing, and the idea of a strong base of middle-class people is being threatened, I think, by you know, by the economy. And so I felt a duty to try to do something here. And I also think that a person is a person wherever he or she happens to live, and I have no more responsibility to Americans you know, than I do to Kenyans or Indians or anybody else, because at the end of the day, we're all people, and it doesn't really matter where you're born, you're still a person. So, you know, we were being accused of favoring people in Africa and India over our neighbors, and I think our response to that is that, you know, we absolutely want to see if our model can work here in the U.S., and I think it'll require some adaptations. I think what we do in Africa will not work here, primarily because there's a wage difference. There's a certain amount of money that companies are willing to pay to have this work done. And most of these companies are no longer willing to pay U.S. living wages to have the kind of work that we do now to have done in the U.S., which just means that we need to find different kinds of work, and we need to be innovative. You know, we need to find things that Americans can do that people in other countries that we work in cannot do as effectively and play to that comparative advantage. And we've seen that that's helped us overall in our workforce. So we've seen that there are some projects that Kenyan workers do particularly well, other projects that Indian workers do particularly well, and I'm confident that we'll find, you know, we'll find a niche for our American workers.
Now, as far as, so that
really makes a lot of sense. As far as looking ahead, do you see some sort of a pathway for your most talented workers to graduate to a different type of work, or building your organization from within, in some sense, from the folks who show particular talent, or have you already done anything along those lines?
It's interesting. That's actually happened pretty organically. 75% of our workers graduate, and it's not a formal graduation program. They basically get coached by other employers in the formal sector or move into higher education. And generally speaking, you know, this work isn't the most exciting work. The tasks involve pretty, boring web research or digitization. In some cases, it can be interesting, and workers sometimes write to us when they're very excited about a project, when they get to say caption. We had one project where they were captioning lectures from a really famous university in the U.S. And so workers were writing in saying that they were really enjoying learning about biology and literature and all these fields and getting a world-class education while they were getting paid to do transcription work. But I'd say most of the work is more boring than that. So a lot of our workers kind of use this as a stepping stone and are able to find better paying work in the formal sector after this because they finally have some experience. And we really view this as a form of bridge employment. It's a way to get people into the formal sector and hopefully have the private sector, again, you know, pay for this development and have SamaSource, which is publicly subsidized, just be a stepping stone. We've seen that a lot of our workers have advanced within the delivery centers that we partner with. We have, you know, one example is a young woman who used to be a data entry agent several years ago in Nairobi, and she was a really incredible worker. She came from a slum community in Kenya, and she's now been charged with setting up a new Sama site, a new center of ours in Ghana with our local partner. So she's, like, you know, taken her first flight and gone to a new country to set up the operation there because she's that good. And these kinds of stories are pretty common for us.
Well, that seems like, I mean, I'm thinking back to this kind of remarkable aspiration or goal. This is really sounds like more of a practical goal you've set for your organization to keep people out of poverty as defined, by the sort of wage guides that you're following for 10 years following their first employment with SamaSource, which is really a pretty audacious and powerful goal you've set for yourself. I just wanted to ask about that in particular. I mean, how did you get to that? At what point did that particular goal work its way in?
I'd say it's kind of evolved organically, and we just finally did the work of setting up our 5-year goals. We want to get to 20,000 workers paid and trained by 2017. Which is about 100,000 people directly impacted from wages. Each worker on average supports 5 dependents. And I'd say the goals are product really of the team that is behind this organization. And I'm proud to say that I, at this point, am just really the talking figurehead and occasionally am the person to kind of ask questions and prod different people. But really, all of the magic happens thanks to the incredible people that we have working at SamaSource, who are, you know, top people in their fields who left big companies like eBay and, you know, Barclays to come and work here. So I'd say a lot of the goals have come out of staff ideas and inspiration after visiting the field or working with us for some time. And I'm now just trying to kind of ride this wave.
No.
I should also mention, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I should also mention I'm really excited about social business even beyond SamaSource. I think that what Muhammad Yunus did to pave the way for other organizations to use the tools of business to solve social problems is so exciting. And I envision SamaSource growing into other social businesses, and eventually I can see many Sama businesses. We started a program called Sama X this year, where I get to incubate special projects as long as they don't bother too many other people in the company, and I can recruit a volunteer to run them initially and find other donors to support them. And so I've launched something called Sama Hope with the help of two incredible people, Sean Graft and Shivani Patel. And these are two entrepreneurs who, you know, had talked to me about SamaSource and then kind of got really interested in this idea that I had to crowdfund life-changing surgeries like fistula repair and cleft palate repair and other medical procedures that people in poor countries can't always afford and that local clinics can provide but often don't have the funds to provide en masse. And so I thought of this idea of creating like a crowdfunding site so that people could each contribute $20 or more towards somebody's surgery and you could actually see the person get better on the site. So that's something called Sama Hope, and it's very much a Skunk Works project. We're launching a Kickstarter campaign next month to fund it. And it's really, again, the product of these two incredible people I recruited to get it started. But that's just one of many Sama Source or Sama businesses that I see expanding into, you know, bigger operations over time. And Sama USA, which is our experiment to the U.S., is another of those. We're actually keeping it separate from Sama Source and launching it as a separate kind of separate organization within Sama. And that's another program that I think could grow to really scale over time.
Well, you were reading my mind because that was going to be my last question for you before we close out our final call-in for Ashoka U Online Summer 2012. And that was going to be, you know, what do you see left ahead that you're not getting to, or what ideas do you have for our participants and friends and partners here on Ashoka U Online that you haven't been able to get to or that you see as being exciting opportunities, and you just offered a couple of them. So I don't know if you have any more or any other kind of closing thoughts, just generally speaking, to the folks online.
Sure. Well, I would say we are in heavy recruiting mode. I'm looking for entrepreneurial people to help me with some of these Sama X projects to lead them and be the future CEOs of them. And we're also just looking for people in the organization to help staff a growing and really exciting social business. So I would say my main message is a very self-interested recruiting message. And beyond that, I'm very excited about the prospect of fixing our current economic system through entrepreneurship. I feel like there's been a lot of talk of reforming financial institutions and changing the regulatory structure that we live under. And for a lot of young people, it can feel like that's just not something that we can participate in directly. But all of us can participate in social business. And, you know, all of us can either start a social business or even more bravely go and join somebody who's already started a social business and be a great operations leader or a great technology leader or a great human resources leader. I mean, all of the people that you need in a traditional business, you need in a social enterprise, and there are far few of them who are really excellent who you can choose from. So I think, you know, there's just infinite room to grow in this space, and the best way to fix the problems that we see around the world, I think, is to show people that there are different models and to provide different examples. So I'm very excited about what lies ahead for SamaSource in the next decade and for our field in general, and so happy to be a part of this show. And, Phil, so grateful for the work that you do.
Well, likewise, and it's been a lot of fun. I can't possibly imagine there's anybody who's been listening in today who would want to work with your organization, but maybe I'm wrong. maybe we'll get some messages from people who are ready to move to San Francisco and be part of what you're doing. I think actually I want to, so maybe I'm one. But Michael, looks like Michael wants to too. So you got two. Thanks so much, Lila. I'm going to close now. You know, if you don't mind just staying on the line so we can both sort of say goodbye in 60 seconds to the whole group. This has been an awesome experience for everybody. It has been a really awesome experience for me and Michael and Aaron and David, the co-instructors here. You know, Lila was talking about, is she done with 3,000 workers and $1 million in resources? And her answer was no. And you know, our answer at Ashoka U Online is definitely
the same, you know, this is we're not done, this course is not over, our relationship with you guys, we really hope is not over, there's a lot we can do together, just one-on-one, and we're just really looking forward to the next thing. So thank you all so much. Stay in touch, finish your assignments, get your certificates, and we look forward to seeing you, possibly another Ashoka U Online course down the road. Okay, so thanks so much, guys.